And we continue now in chapter 21, The Order of the Worlds in Sri Aurobindo's Life Divine. A few pages back, he asked whether there was any evidence to indicate the reality of superphysical worlds, and if so, what is the nature of these worlds, and are these worlds interdependent or independent? Do they impinge upon the Earth's experience, or are they free and above it? So Sri Aurobindo has been sedulously going through argument after argument, determining that simply measuring the reality of superphysical worlds from the baseline of physical experience is inadequate, cannot possibly account for all that our inner experience delivers to us. Indeed, we seem to have subjective experience of the reality of inner powers of being, which we would call life and mind, outside of the range of the physical orbit. More, they have not simply a subjective character, but they also have a subjective objective character. In other words, it is a subject moving in a world which also is objective, but not in the same manner in which the physical is objective. It is not dependent upon the gross physical body. So, Sri Aurobindo has now to see if the nature of our experience in these superphysical worlds impinges upon the physical in a way that completes the evolutionary intention, or whether those superphysical worlds are apart from the evolutionary intention. Do they arise out of the physical into a kind of superphysical status by dint of the engine of cosmic movement, or do they pre-exist? So we might have a real experience of them subjectively, but do they come from the gross machinery of the external world or not? That's the next question that he puts forward. So, he writes, one explanation which can be put forward is that man himself creates the superphysical worlds which he inhabits or thinks he inhabits after death, creates the gods, as ran the ancient phrase. It is claimed even that God himself was created by man, was a myth of his consciousness, and has now been abolished by man. All these things, then, may be a sort of myth of the developing consciousness in which it is able to dwell, a captive in its own buildings, and by a kind of realizing dynamization, maintain itself in its own imaginations. In other words, do we give rise to these things from the subject matter of our own experience? Have we created in mythic form the gods, the inner worlds, and the supreme divine himself? But pure imaginations, they are not. They can only be so treated by us so long as the things they represent, however incorrectly, are not part of our own experience. And you will remember how important experience is in attesting whether something is real or not. It has not simply to stand the test of reason and logic, but has also to be part of the body of our experience, to be ordained as true. Yet there may conceivably be myths and imaginations that are used by the power of the creative consciousness force to materialize its own idea forces. These potent images may take form and body, endure in some subtly materialized world of thought, and react on their creator. If so, we might suppose that the other worlds are buildings of this character. But if that were so, if a subjective consciousness can thus create worlds and beings, it might well be that the objective world also is a myth of consciousness, or even of our consciousness, or that consciousness itself is a myth of the original nescience. So here we wind up in that field of subjective idealism, which can take us to an abrupt departure into nihilism. Sri Aurobindo will find neither one of those things acceptable, because consciousness must be real, can't simply be a figment-making agency that creates a world that has no substance. If consciousness creates a world, it must have reality in it, because consciousness itself is real. Thus, on this line of thinking, we swing back towards a view of the universe in which all things assume a certain hue of unreality, except the all-productive inconscience out of which they are created, the ignorance which creates them, and, it may be, a superconscient or inconscient impersonal being into whose indifference all finally disappears or goes back and ceases there. So it can be an inconscience, which couldn't care a hoot about us, or it could be Brahman, which in its indifference doesn't recognize us and doesn't care a hoot about us. But he says neither of these can really be the ultimate substratum of the world. So he continues, but we have no proof, and there is no likelihood that man's mind can create in this way a world where none was before, create in vacuo, without a substance to build in or build on, though it may well be that it can add something to a world already made. Mind is indeed a potent agency, more potent than we readily imagine. It can make formations which effectuate themselves in our own or others' consciousness and lives, and even have an effect on inconscient matter. But an entirely original creation in the void is beyond its possibilities. What we can rather hazard is that as it grows, man's mind enters into relation with new ranges of being and consciousness, not at all created by him, new to him, already pre-existent in the all-existence. So one might imagine that there is much in the universe that is stated upwards, that as we grow and grow upwards, we come to meet. We don't create it. In his increasing inner experience, he opens up new planes of being in himself. As the secret centers of his consciousness dissolve their knots, he becomes able, through them, to conceive of those larger realms, to receive direct influences from them, to enter into them, to image them in his terrestrial mind and inner sense. He does create images, symbol forms, reflective shapes of them with which his mind can deal. In this sense only he creates the divine image that he worships, creates the forms of the gods, creates new planes and worlds within him, and through these images, the real worlds and powers that overtop our existence are able to take possession of the consciousness in the physical world, to pour into it their potencies, to transform it with the light of their higher being. But all this is not a creation of the higher worlds of being. It is a revelation of them to the consciousness of the soul on the material plane as it develops out of the nescience. So the superphysical worlds can pour in through the mind's images and figures potencies which come from themselves, but it's simply the casting into form and the applying of names which the mind provides as an agency. It is not a real creator. It packages. It is, he says, a creation of their forms here by a reception of their powers. There is an enlargement of our subjective life on this plane by the discovery of its true relation with higher planes of its own being, from which it was separated by the veil of the material nescience. This veil exists because the soul in the body has put behind it these greater possibilities in order that it might concentrate exclusively its consciousness and force upon its primary work in this physical world of being. But that primary work can have a sequel only by the veil being at least partially lifted or else made penetrable so that the higher planes of mind, life, and spirit may pour their significances into human existence. So we've put these greater worlds behind us so that we can get busy in the material world and start the process of evolution and carry it forward. But at some point, there has to be a rift. There has to be an aperture in all of this so that we can lift that veil, get a glimpse of what is more largely true, and then feel the cascading influences of these greater planes of being, life, mind, and the spirit, supramental, etc., the higher ranges of the mind consciousness, into us. It is possible to suppose that these higher planes and worlds have been created subsequently to the manifestation of the material cosmos to aid the evolution or in some sense as a result of it. In other words, they don't pre-exist. They arise only after the material cosmos begins and come into being post-creation. They're not there before creation of the material world, in this idea. This is a notion which the physical mind, starting in all its ideas from the material universe as the one thing which it knows, has analyzed and can deal with in a beginning of mastery, might easily tend to accept if obliged to admit a superphysical existence. It could then keep the material, the inconscience, as the starting point and support of all being, as it is undoubtedly the starting point for us of the evolutionary movement of which the material world is the scene. So it would accept superphysical worlds if all begins from the inconscience. This is not something Sri Aurobindo has conceded, because to him, obviously, the incipience of the cosmos is above. It's in the superphysical. It's in Satchitananda pouring itself out through the supermind, enclosing, encasing itself in an involutionary stairway that leads down to the basement of the inconscience from which evolution begins. We don't dispute that evolution begins from there, but there is a prior involution that has pressed all these grades of reality into this material encasement. Our mind, he writes, could still keep matter and material force as the first existence, so accepted and cherished by it because it is the first thing that it knows, the one thing that is always securely present and knowable, and maintain the spiritual and the supraphysical in a dependence upon the assured foundation in matter. Footnote. There are certain expressions in the Rig Veda which seem to embody this view. Earth, the material principle, is spoken of as the foundation of all the worlds, or the seven worlds are described as the seven planes of earth. So there is that suggestion there. One might also acknowledge that there is not one cosmology in the Rig Veda, but several worldviews find their articulation there. But how then were these other worlds created? By what force? By what instrumentality? It might be the life and mind developing out of the inconscient, which have, at the same time, developed these other worlds or planes in the subliminal consciousness of the living beings who appear in it. To the subliminal being in life and after death, for it is the inner being that survives the death of the body, these worlds might be real because sensible to its wider range of consciousness. It would move in them with that sense of reality, derivative perhaps, but convincing, and it would send up its experience of them as belief and imagination to the surface being. This is a possible account if we accept consciousness as the real creative power or agent, and all things as formations of consciousness. But it would not give to the superphysical planes of being the unsubstantiality or less palpable reality which the physical mind would like to attach to them. They would have the same reality in themselves as the physical world or plane of physical experience has in its own order. So that's the good news. If in this or some other way the higher worlds were developed subsequently to the creation of the material world, the primary creation by a larger secret evolution out of the inconscient, it must have been done by some all soul in its emergence, by a process of which we can have no knowledge, and for the purpose of the evolution here, as adjuncts to it, or as its larger consequences, so that life and mind and spirit might be able to move in fields of a freer scope with a repercussion of these greater powers and experiences on the material self-expression. But against this hypothesis, there stands the fact that we find these higher worlds in our vision and experience of them to be in no way based upon the material universe, in no way its results, but rather greater terms of being, larger and freer ranges of consciousness, and all the action of the material plane looks more like the result and not the origin of these greater terms, derivatory from them, even partly dependent on them in its evolutionary endeavor. So again, we come back to Sri Aurobindo's epistemology. Experience leads us to knowledge, not logic. So that our experience delivers to us a greater perspective, a more penetrating view, is what will determine our ultimate assessment of the cosmos. We will not rely upon logic and reason. Not that they are not important as adjuncts to our exploration, that fundamentally it has to make sense to us. And if we can move in these superphysical planes, and have experience of them directly and find them to be greater realities and find instead of them being derived from physical experience, but more likely to pour their influence into our physical experience and into the actual physical world, then we'll accept that. So he continues. And here he's developing his own view from this point. For the rest of the paragraph, immense ranges of powers, influences, phenomena descend covertly upon us from the overmind and the higher mental and vital ranges, but of these only a part, a selection as it were, or restricted number, can stage and realize themselves in the order of the physical world. The rest await their time and proper circumstance for revelation in physical term and form, for their part in the terrestrial evolution, which is at the same time an evolution of all the powers of the spirit. Let's look at that footnote to the word terrestrial. Necessarily, he writes, by terrestrial, we do not mean this one earth and its period of duration, but use earth in the wider root sense of the Vedantic Prithvi, the earth principle creating habitations of physical form for the soul. So Sri Aurobindo has just freed himself from positing a single universe, a single kind of physicality. And this obviously echoes from the earlier Vedic mention of the nature of the earth. This character of the other worlds defeats all our attempts to give the premier importance to our own plane of being and to our own part in the mundane manifestation. We do not create God as a myth of our consciousness, but are instruments for a progressive manifestation of the divine in the material being. We do not create the gods, his powers, but rather such divinity as we manifest is the partial reflection and the shaping here of eternal godheads. We do not create the higher planes, but are intermediaries by which they reveal their light, power, beauty, in whatever form and scope can be given to them by nature force, on the material plane. It is the pressure of the life world which enables life to evolve and develop here in the forms we already know. It is that increasing pressure which drives it to aspire in us to a greater revelation of itself, and will one day deliver the mortal from his subjection to the narrow limitations of his present incompetent and restricting physicality. It is the pressure of the mind world, which evolves and develops mind here, and helps us to find a leverage for our mental self-uplifting and expansion, so that we may hope to enlarge continually our self of intelligence, and even to break the prison walls of our matter-bound physical mentality. It is the pressure of the supramental and spiritual worlds which is preparing to develop here the manifest power of the spirit, and by it open our being on the physical plane into the freedom and infinity of the superconscient divine. That contact, that pressure, can alone liberate from the apparent inconscience, which was our starting point, the all-conscient Godhead concealed in us. In this order of things, our human consciousness is the instrument, the intermediary. It is the point in the development of light and power out of the inconscience at which liberation becomes possible. A greater role than this we cannot attribute to it, but this is great enough, for it makes our humanity all important for the supreme purpose of evolutionary nature. So no, we don't create God from our imagination, or the Godheads. We feel their pressure upon us. The Godheads of the life world lean through our living matter into the world. Great ideas beckon to us and get born in us from the plane of the mind. The supramental also presses upon us and calls us, stirs our aspiration. And all of this occurs within the human. The human soul receiving in this base of matter the greater powers that exist above, finds them embedded within, forges them in this body into action, and charges towards a greater goal. This is wonderful. And it is enough for us. We cannot say that humanity is the culmination of the evolutionary curve, but we can say that we represent the possibility of liberation from the ancient binding ignorance with which the world began from the inconscience. We can be the point at which we begin to recover the true nature of Satchit Ananda as it manifests in name and form here. He continues, at the same time, there are some elements in our subliminal experience which raise a point of question against any invariable priority of the other worlds to the material existence. One such indication is that in the vision of after-death experience, there is a persistent tradition of residence in conditions which seem to be a superphysical prolongation of earth conditions, earth nature, earth experience. So he's giving another chance to the opposing side to explain to it why it isn't that we're based on earth experience. Why is that free of that? Another is that, in the life worlds especially, we find formulations which seem to resemble the inferior movements of earth existence. Here are already embodied the principles of darkness, falsehood, incapacity, and evil, which we have supposed to be consequent upon the evolution out of the material inconscience. It seems even to be the fact that the vital worlds are the natural home of the powers that most disturb human life. This is indeed logical, for it is through our vital being that they sway us, and they must therefore be powers of a larger and more powerful life existence. The descent of mind and life into evolution need not have created any such untoward developments of limitation of being and consciousness, for this descent is in its nature a limitation of knowledge. Existence and cognition and delight of being confine themselves in a lesser truth and good and beauty and its inferior harmony, and move according to that law of a narrower light. But in such a movement, darkness and suffering and evil are not obligatory phenomena. If we find them existing in these worlds of other mind and other life, even though not pervading it, but only occupying their separate province, we must either conclude that they have come into existence by a projection out of the inferior evolution, upward from below, by something in the subliminal parts of nature bursting there into a larger formation of the evil created here, or that they were already created as part of a parallel gradation to the involutionary descent, a gradation forming a stair for evolutionary ascension towards spirit, just as the involutionary was a stair of the descent of the spirit. In the latter hypothesis, the ascending gradation might have a double purpose, for it would contain preformations of the good and evil that must evolve in the earth as part of the struggle necessary for the evolutionary growth of the soul and nature. These would be formations existing for themselves, for their own independent satisfaction. Formations that would present the full type of these things, each in its separate nature, and at the same time, they would exercise on evolutionary beings their characteristic influence. These worlds of a larger life would then hold in themselves both the more luminous and the darker formations of our world's life in a medium in which they could arrive freely at their independent expression, their own type's full freedom and natural completeness and harmony for good or for evil, if indeed that distinction applies in these ranges. A completeness and independence impossible here in our existence, where all is mingled in the complex interaction necessary to the field of a many-sided evolution leading towards a final integration. For we find what we call false, dark, or evil seems there to have a truth of its own and to be entirely content with its own type, because it possesses that in a full expression which creates in it a sense of a satisfied power of its own being, an accord, a complete adaptation of all its circumstances to its principle of existence. It enjoys there its own consciousness, its own self-power, its own delight of being, obnoxious to our minds, but to itself, full of the joy of satisfied desire. So this is a field of being where what is dark, dangerous, and evil can fully investigate itself, is free to do it on those vital planes, in those worlds within the vital plane, which are appropriate to that. They can freely explore that there. They cannot carry all of that danger and all of that destructive power to earth and manifest in the physical, because that would be inappropriate and we find it to be obnoxious when at all they manifest. But there, in those planes, they fully and truly have the capacity to explore all of that, which again is Sri Aurobindo's point. It indicates that those worlds are free from determination from the physical. They exist independently, but interpenetrate our world here, can pour their influences upon us, but retain their own characteristic principle and live in their province according to their own law. This, of course, you find in Savitri. Sri Aurobindo spends canto after canto after canto describing the nature of the many planes of being interior to the physical, all the subliminal ranges of being, from the happy life worlds through the dark and dangerous worlds all the way up to the most glorious vistas of the mind are described there. So you can collate in some ways what is in Savitri, with what is in Life Divine being written here. Let me see if I can find where I quit reading. Those life impulses, which are to earth nature inordinate and out of measure and appear here as perverse and abnormal, find in their own province of being an independent fulfillment and an unrestricted play of their type and principle. What is to us divine or titanic, rakshasic, demoniac, and therefore supernatural, is, each in its own domain, normal to itself, and gives to the beings that embody these things the feeling of self-nature and the harmony of their own principle. Discord itself, struggle, incapacity, suffering, enter into a certain kind of life satisfaction which would feel itself balked or deficient without them. And as freedom is the nature of the manifestation, they must be given their inning on their plane of being. When these powers are seen in their isolated working, building their own life edifices, as they do in those secret worlds where they dominate, we perceive more clearly their origin and reason of existence, and the reason also for the hold they have on human life and the attachment of man to his own imperfections, to his life drama of victory and failure, happiness and suffering, laughter and tears, sin and virtue. So these things can manifest in us with such a hold that we seem not to be able to shake free of them, not altogether from the call of the inconscience back to itself, but also from these nether forces placing upon us their dark influences from these interior worlds. Here on earth, these things exist in an unsatisfied and therefore unsatisfactory and obscure state of struggle and mixture. But there, reveal their secret and their motive of being because they are there established in their native power and full form of nature in their own world and their own exclusive atmosphere. Man's heavens and hells, or worlds of light and worlds of darkness, however imaginative in their building, proceed from a perception of these powers existing in their own principle and throwing their influences on him in life from a beyond life which provides the elements of his evolutionary existence. And so it hardly needs to be noted that if one were to break loose from the physical moorings of the senses and develop some capacity to move through the interior of the cosmos and range through these places that Sri Aurobindo is describing here, you had better be fully equipped for the journey because you will meet beings, as he says in Savitri, whose very gaze is a calamity. So, be strong, be sure of your soul power if you decide to venture forth. In the same way as the powers of life are self-founded, perfect and full in a greater life beyond us, so too the powers of mind, its ideas and principles that influence our earth being, are found to have in the greater mind world their own field of fullness of self-nature. While here in human existence, they throw out only partial formations which have much difficulty in establishing themselves because of their meeting and mixture with other powers and principles. This meeting, this mixture, curbs their completeness, alloys their purity, disputes and defeats their influence. These other worlds, then, are not evolutionary. but typal. But it is one, though not the sole reason of their existence, that they provide things that must arise in the involutionary manifestation, as well as things thrown up in the evolution with a field of satisfaction of their own significance where they can exist in their own right. This established condition is a base from which their functions and workings can be cast as elements into the complex process of evolutionary nature. So these worlds are typal. They live according to their own type on their own planes, but nevertheless can pour from their own sources and origins their influences, powers, ideas into our physical being. Our base receives them, and we use them as elements for the construction of evolution. So I think that's a good place to put a bookmark. We've come a long way tonight. And a special note of regard and support and affection to our friends who are with us on Zoom tonight who live in the Houston and Galveston area. Our prayers, our embrace are with you. We love you. Let us know how we can help. Let's read from Savitri. This is a section now in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. In the witness's occult rooms, with mind-built walls on hidden interiors, lurking passages open the windows of the inner sight. He owned the house of undivided time. Lifting the heavy curtain of the flesh, he stood upon a threshold, serpent-watched, and peered into gleaming endless corridors. Silent and listening in the silent heart for the coming of the new and the unknown. He gazed across the empty stillnesses and heard the footsteps of the undreamed idea in the far avenues of the beyond. He heard the secret voice, the word that knows, and saw the secret face that is our own. The inner planes uncovered their crystal doors. Strange powers and influences touched his life. A vision came of higher realms than ours, a consciousness of brighter fields and skies, of beings less circumscribed than brief-lived men, and subtler bodies than these passing frames, objects too fine for our material grasp, acts vibrant with a superhuman light, and movements pushed by a superconscient force, and joys that never flowed through mortal limbs, and lovelier scenes than Earth's, and happier lives. A consciousness of beauty and of bliss, a knowledge which became what it perceived, replaced the separated sense and heart, and drew all nature into its embrace. The mind leaned out to meet the hidden worlds. Air glowed and teemed with marvelous shapes and hues. In the nostrils quivered celestial fragrances. On the tongue lingered the honey of paradise. A channel of universal harmony. Hearing was a stream of magic audience, a bed for occult sounds earth cannot hear. Out of a covert tract of slumber self, the voice came of a truth submerged, unknown, that flows beneath the cosmic surfaces, only mid an omniscient silence heard, held by intuitive heart and secret sense. It caught the burden of secrecies, sealed and dumb. It voiced the unfulfilled demand of earth and the song of promise of unrealized heavens, and all that hides in an omnipotent sleep. In the unceasing drama carried by time, on its long listening flood that bears the world's insoluble doubt, on a pilgrimage without goal, a laughter of sleepless pleasure foamed and spumed, and murmurings of desire that cannot die. A cry came of the world's delight to be, the grandeur and greatness of its will to live, recall of the soul's adventure into space, a traveler through the magic centuries and being's labor in matter's universe, its search for the mystic meaning of its birth and joy of high spiritual response, its throb of satisfaction and content in all the sweetness of the gifts of life, its large breath and pulse and thrill of hope and fear, its taste of pangs and tears and ecstasy, its rapture's poignant beat of sudden bliss, the sob of its passion and unending pain. The murmur and whisper of the unheard sounds, which crowd around our hearts but find no window to enter, swelled into a canticle of all that suffers to be still unknown, and all that labors vainly to be born, and all the sweetness none will ever taste, and all the beauty that will never be. Inaudible to our deaf mortal ears, the wide world rhythms wove their stupendous chant, to which life strives to fit our rhyme beats here, melting our limits in the illimitable, tuning the finite to infinity. So next week, we complete this chapter. It will be a special day. And we'll speak about why that is when next we gather to read The Life Divine together. Much love to you all. Namaste. Jai Ma.